Welcome to the Vinyl Preacher, your weekly 180-gram vinyl podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cato, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
Matt, you say one slightly critical thing about Bruce Springsteen, and he comes and steps on our corner immediately.
Oh, he did. Yeah, you really would have loved to have a reaction video when I was randomly scrolling Facebook and saw that they announced a podcast with two of my favorite celebrities in the world, Bruce Springsteen and Barack Obama, doing a podcast together. I mean, what's next?
I can only assume, Matt, based on your devotion to the boss and the fact that we have been neighbors with President Obama, that we will likely be doing a crossover episode to help them find an audience, you know?
you would think that.
So listeners, get ready. I can only assume it's no official word yet, but I mean, put two and two together and we're on a podcast with Bruce and Barack.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. Got a lot in common with us, so there's that. It's good. I listened to both episodes on a long drive the other day, immediately, within a couple hours of its release, and it was good. A lot of people making fun of it. I read one. Well, I don't know, but I did read one review that was like, I don't really need to listen to this. Like, Barack Obama was the most heard man in the world for 8 years, and these two boomers, like, talking to each other. I get it. It's fair. You know, whatever. But they're, like, thoughtful people having these thoughtful conversations, and I was kind of impressed, like, Obama kind of pushes Springsteen a little bit on race stuff, particularly, like, his relationship with Clarence Clemons and, like, the nature of being the boss in the band, right? And, like, all these, like, power dynamics. And he was, like, pushed, and I was like, oh, this is interesting. This is better than, like, your typical fluff, celebrity thing. So it was interesting. If you're into either of those two people, it was worth a listen. If you're not, it's fine. I get it. And they should come on our podcast.
Yeah. No, we can help push them. You know, they need a little help with that.
They did make a playlist of their favorite protest songs. At least one of which made it onto my playlist for today.
So. Ooh, something to look forward to for those of us who've not listened to the podcast yet. Matt, I've been explaining the Bible. We talked a little bit last week about a little Why Christianity course that I'm leading for students right now. And first things first, I mentioned that I had more people sign up for it than I was planning on it. Comes with a little stipend, and I need a little extra stipend money. And do you know what happened this week, Matt? A dear listener of the pod Venmo'd the ministry a significant amount of change that... fundraising goals met, exceeded. We're set up for the semester.
Well done.
So
well done, sir. Well done. And thank you, anonymous
donator. Thank you to anonymous donator, and shame on every other one of you. It's at B Boulder, BEBOULDER, and you didn't donate. So just think about that tonight when you're going to sleep. But it we didn't get very far, Matt, as I predicted. We may not be able to explain, to make the case of Christianity in 6 1-hour courses. We're two in, and I thought maybe we'd do one session of the Bible, and all I was able to accomplish in that hour, Matt, pretty good. I had some pretty good links, was we deconstructed the Bible.
Okay, good.
It's an important part. When you leave at the end of that, it's not like you've made the case for why the Bible is great. When you take it all apart and, like, look at all this disassembled, flawed document full of very human stories. I think it's good, right? Like, I mean, oh, Matt, that's the part I am a little, like, worried about. And maybe that's why, I mean, so a lot of the stuff that we were talking about was stuff that as you say, I was seminary years old when I learned. And there is a compulsion for those of us who've been who've experienced theological education to want to share the stuff that we we learned, right? Like, in that sort of like impulsive sort of like, how did I not know this? You should know this, right? And sometimes it's really stuff people don't care about, like Third Isaiah. But lots of it can be good. But there is, I think, I was surprised in myself the kind of like, as I got into it, the kind of fear I had of like, oh no, what if I just like break all this stuff and then like I'm not able to help them put it back together? Which is, I mean, has its own cruciform shape, but maybe that's a part of why we were only seminary years old when we learned those things.
Because you had to be able to put it back together?
Because the church is scared to break it, that because we may not put it back together.
Yeah. So you just deconstructed it and left it in pieces.
Just left it. Well, I said, I had some pretty good ones in here, Matt. I said you should read the Bible like Harry Potter. I probably said that on here before, right? And that there are a lot of similarities, right? Did you know there's a ton of errors in Harry Potter? Like, in prepping, I prepped for this, for the class. I went to the Harry Potter wiki page, and like, it's just pages and pages. You could scroll forever to find all the inconsistencies in the Harry Potter books, which is not surprising given the page count, right? The word count and
sure,
all the issues. Yeah. And I don't know if you know this, Matt, but the Bibles can sometimes be problematic. And Harry Potter, it turns out these days, could also be problematic from time to time, especially when you consider the author. And then I had everybody fill out, do a BuzzFeed quiz on which, like a sorting hat sort of quiz. Because I said that's the most important biblical skill, not the ability to like quote Paul out of context.
But take a BuzzFeed quiz?
To be able to see yourself in the stories and see the stories in your stories. So to do the work of like of identifying with the different Hogwarts houses that I don't know. Hufflepuff is one, Ravenclaw, and that's half of them, I believe. I know there are four. It's like the Gospels. Hufflepuff, definitely. Let's do this, Matt. This is a fun game.
Hufflepuff, Ravenclaw, Slytherin, and Gryffindor. Come on.
Sure. Now assign them to the Gospels. Which Gospel is which?
Oh my gosh. I don't know that I could. I mean, maybe I could. I've always been of the. I never understood those tests because I've never understood why anyone would want to be anything other than Gryffindor.
I mean, Gryffindor is.
All the heroes are from Gryffindor. I don't understand why. Who wants to be one of these side houses? True. I don't get it.
Side house. Is it Luke then? I mean, that's what I would say. Or Matthew. Matthew's pretty self-righteous.
Yeah, maybe.
Little John Ravenclaw.
I guess I think John just because of like the eagle, but I guess it's like a griffin is a. I think he doesn't fit any of them.
Gryffindor has to be Mark, I believe, because of the griffin, the lion part.
Do you think? You think? I don't. Yeah. I don't know.
Listeners, write in.
It's going to take
some work.
Don't
depend on my Harry Potter Lily illiterate self to give you the things you need to.
Yeah, the deconstruction is a really, it's a challenging question. I mean, it's one of the reasons I miss teaching confirmation because I just loved getting into those spaces. And I mean, you know, we're not full on deconstructing at the college level, obviously, but to start to, you know, ask hard questions of students and,
you take so much fun. Seventh graders so much... deep into the history of the Assyrian Empire.
I mean, it didn't take us long, right, to get to like, you know, to get from, oh, God is like a white dude with a beard to like, oh, let's look up some of these other metaphors for God that are in the scriptures. And then the kids are suggesting that God is gender fluid. And these are seventh graders suggesting that language to describe God. And it's just like, yeah, this is like, yeah, this is super fun. I remember too, when I was in CPE and I was at a fairly conservative, Christian sponsored, homeless shelter. They did good, like social work, but the leader was a Missouri Synod Lutheran. And so I remember her like finding out that I was not anymore Missouri Synod Lutheran, and she was almost like, I don't think she literally like jabbed me in the chest with her finger, but it was that kind of tone of her voice, like to say, well, do you believe that the Bible is inerrant? Do you believe in the inerrant word of God? And it was such a like, but it was such a like, I remember I went home on the red line that day and I was just like, sitting with that question, like, well, of course I don't, but like, what are, like, to put that question right to you, like, what is your tone. What is your response? Maybe now I'd just be like, no, and I just move on because I have other things to worry about. But I remember on that train ride home thinking about how I found it, that I had come to find it much more powerful that the Bible was written by flawed human beings, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't some, I don't know, thing beyond us, but that it was written by folks like us. And so that's, you know, to your point, finding yourself in the text. I don't know when you come to that point. I don't know if you have to come. Maybe, like, some folks come full circle, and maybe you don't. Maybe you stay in another place. But, yeah. What an interesting journey to be on with your folks.
We took, we addressed all of the I's. I did spend some spent some time in some interesting parts of the internet, in bro evangelical blogs. To figure out what exactly inerrant and inspired and infallible meant. I addressed them all. And I had internalized, right, that, like, by breaking these things, it's freedom, right? Like, you don't have to, like, it's freedom, right? So I broke them all for them, right? And had, like, examples. And one of them was with the inspired or infallible, and I forget. And I was like, oh, they don't know the Bible. Like, they're not biblical. Like, they don't know very many Bible stories, right? Let's find a Bible story that's, like, irredeemable. So I pulled out my philistical or tribal text of terror. And on YouTube, you can find, like, some pretty good, like, animated Bible stories. And I found an animated Bible story that was pretty true to the text of, like, the daughter of Jephthah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was excited to be like, look, it's broken. This story's terrible. You can't redeem this. And then it was like, I saw their faces and I was like, oh, I just dug a hole and, like, left them in it and was like,
I was preaching, this would be on me, but I'm not preaching. This is my study. I can dig holes and leave them.
You should see how this is good. Like, this horrible story about murdering his daughter is good.
Wow.
I was all excited for the video, because it was good.
Was it like an actual, like, Sunday school children's video?
This one wasn't. I found a number of, like, I used some videos to, like, Saddleback has some stuff.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
We used a couple of those.
Yeah, I mean, if you
they're
like...
Most of them aren't terrible. They could be better, but...
They haven't seen the one coming up where I'm going to do some reconstruction where, like, we're going to talk about Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch, you know, where my point will be it's completely unremarkable in the story that the person is a eunuch, but they include the detail, right? So they're totally okay with more than one gender, outside of gender binary. But the Saddleback version of it is the Philip and the Ethiopian man or official or prince or definitely not a eunuch. but it was a video called "Does God Allow Human Sacrifice for Jephthah's Daughter?" And then the guy, like, really tried to, like, rework it to say, like, this is not what God wanted. It's not even clear if he actually did murder his daughter. I mean, it's likely, but it wasn't what God wanted. God does not like human sacrifice. Yeah, obviously. I don't think this is the story where you make your stand on God is against human sacrifice. God, there's some other ones that are better at that.
Yeah. Well done, sir. Well done. The extent of my work in that regard these days is taking my kids through the Holy Moly Sunday School. That's as far as I've gotten.
How's Holy Moly? Any golf yet? Steph Anyone? Curry? Any golf? Mini golf? Steph Curry?
Nope, not that. Not that.
You gotta watch it. It's on Hulu. It's great.
Holy moly. Not that one.
Hilarious.
Oh.
Rob Riggle's in it.
I'm gonna send you the, I need to send you the Holy Moly video, though, of Jacob wrestling.
Please do.
The River Javits, because it's pretty good. I like what they did with it.
I would like to register one formal complaint against an almost sponsor. It was kind of last second. I don't have tons of free time these days, you know? And I was like, oh, crap, what am I going to do for tonight? And as, like, a last-ditch effort to try to, like, save myself, I went to Sparkhouse and Animate, and, like, I bought the single, like, video they have on the Bible. Mm. And wasn't very good. Didn't work for me at all. Couldn't use it. I spent $20 on a life jacket that didn't work.
Wow. Which one was it?
It was the Bible. In their, like, original series or whatever?
Yeah, the anime, the Bible series?
Is not like the Bible a, series.
A single five-minute one and the whole thing?
A single, from the original series, one of the videos was on the Bible. So I bought that one. And, because I've used some of the other ones before, and they're pretty, like, I used Phyllis Tickle.
Mm-hmm.
Hers was pretty good. The Sarah Miles one was pretty good. But this one was not particularly good.
Yeah, the two Nadia ones are pretty good too. Well, good job. You're doing your job here in Lent. Well done.
That's right. And to support it, all you gotta do is take your Venmo and shoot cash money over to @BeBoulder, where you can help students leave on a Tuesday night depressed because I've read them in great detail a Bible story that is beyond redemption.
Well done.
Next up, the one in Judges where they cut the daughter into 12 pieces and send her body to the 12 tribes as a warning.
Oh, my gosh. Well, we have no texts like that today.
Well, that's fantastic. Because it doesn't preach.
Maybe. We'll see. Third Sunday in Lent.
Halfway there.
Halfway there. Exodus 20. 1-17. See, we're getting these covenants. So what do we have? We had Noah's rainbow. We had Abraham looking at the stars. God's going to make this covenant. We didn't get the bloody animals. I don't think.
Which is a bummer. I really like that one.
Just the stars. And now we get the covenant of the Ten Commandments. These do seem to require some kind of action on the part of the humans.
They do. Or inaction.
Right? Action,
most of them are negative, right? Don't do this. It's with the Luther, like, he who gets drunk falls asleep and can't sin.
Oh, my goodness. God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the iniquity of parents, to the third and fourth generation of those who
chill
reject
out,
me.
Dude.
Good. I thought we were in a safe text, but there are no safe scriptures, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the seventh day, the Sabbath day, and consecrated it. Honor your father and mother, so your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. Now it feels like we're just trying to get through them. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or male or female slave, or ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Word of God, word of life. All right, I misjudged the text. I thought it was going to be pretty simple and straightforward, but we've got some...
It's a listicle.
It's a listicle. It's definitely a listicle. Some troubling things about slavery. I mean, it starts off well. I don't know. It's clear. I mean, it's... Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Matt, you read the story, so you've dug the hole.
I mean, it's like... We always picture these Ten Commandments as, like, coming down, chiseled. By God. It's the one part of the Bible that we actually picture literally being chiseled.
That's right. Inspired.
To a slab of rock. but there's clearly some human, I don't know, structures of society built into it.
Humans are involved, man. I mean, I think it's a good joke, but it also, like, does... I think it's a Ralph Klein thing. Whose website now rests in peace. You got to find, like, your time machine to go to ot-studies.com. But one of his things, right, was that the Ten Commandments are not very demanding. You know, right? Like I don't want to brag, Matt. This isn't a braggadocious podcast. We typically, you know, try to trade in humility and laughing at ourselves. But today I didn't murder. I did not commit adultery. Did not steal or bear false witness. I didn't covet my neighbor's house or ox, though I had the opportunity to. I didn't do those things. I didn't, you know, set up any false idols. Not doing anything one day is surprisingly hard, but I, if I put my mind to it, I can do it. You know, it really isn't that. We perhaps read the intent of, like, rules. I don't know whether it's American, Westerners, whatever, as being burdensome. But these negative rules, at least, are pretty easy to check off the box.
So Luther comes in and says, these are too easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's where it starts. Martin Luther, and these are too easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, right, like Ten Commandments is pretty low bar, you know?
It does. It seems to be a low bar. Today, though, I'm thinking about it in the context of this gospel that we're about to get to, because these texts, although it seems like in year B, there is this through line of the covenant, but I assume they're also trying to do some tie-in to the gospel. And so it's interesting to think about the Ten Commandments in the context of what we're going to hear here. It also makes me think, and on that line of thinking, it makes me think about The Good Place.
Mm.
Yep, just went there, where they're trying to figure out, like, are there any humans that are not wrapped up and complicit,
right? Yeah.
In all of the evil that's going on, can you actually be a good person? And so even though we just went down this line and said, oh, I haven't done any of these things, is it in fact impossible for us to extricate ourselves from humanity's breaking of these commandments?
Yeah. So we're at a preach this week, man, which I'm not, so I've got real freedom here. I think, you know, there are plenty of ways to turn the commandments into good news, you know, right? You shall not murder. The good news is pretty good. God's vision for the world that we are called to live into is a world without murder and without adultery and without stealing and without all these things. But I would go to that part that sounds a little terrible. I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, punishing children for the inequity of the parents to the third and fourth generation, but showing steadfast love to the thousandth generation. And that comparison to the third or fourth generation versus the thousandth generation sounds super scary, but also I think it's honest. It's kind of like what we were talking about before, when you break stuff in the Bible, that breaking of things ultimately gets us to a freedom, and that there's freedom and that there's more power in honesty, because the reality of things is, when we don't live in rhythm with the ways that God is calling us to live, there are consequences. I just got a book rec here, Matt. A book rec called A Children's Bible. It's a novel about these. It's kind of a Lord of the Flies kind of vibe-ish. Sort of like that kind of like universe. It's not that kind of intense. It's intense in a different way. This kid stumbles, is randomly given a children's Bible. And then it starts to come to life, you know. And that's tied up in, like, the repercussions of climate change. It's partially, like, a futuristic dystopian thing, right? So the repercussions of climate change, the repercussions of our sinfulness are going to last for generations and, generations to come. And yet, in the face of that, right, the promise is that even though those things will follow us, the love of God will follow us, the life of God will follow us even exponentially further.
I like that. Well done, sir. You found good news. You got us out of the hole.
You can find out more good news next week, Tuesday night at 8 o'clock Mountain Time, for Why the Bible Part 2.
Good plug. Let's hear this gospel.
The gospel's interesting, Matt. Interesting. This is one of the few stories that is in all four accounts of the Bible, and this is year B, and all of our listeners, of course, know that year B is the year we spend in the Gospel of Mark. And come this time of year, we throw a lot of John in there because Mark is not so long. But Mark has his own account of this story. But instead, we are given John. And one of the interesting things about John is that this passage happens very early in John. It typically happens pretty late. Like in Mark, it happens when Jesus, a couple episodes after Jesus comes into Jerusalem on like Palm Sunday. But here we are right on the tails of the wedding at Cana. The Passover of, and here's an important thing to say, the Judeans was near. Your NRSV is going to say Jews. There are lots of good reasons to avoid doing John, the Gospel of John's calling folks Jews. One of them, though, that's true of the text, is that an important part of the Gospel of John is drawing this distinction between the powers that be that were Judean in the south and Jesus' identity as someone from the north or Galilee, who's considered a Galilean, who, though he was Jewish, was considered an outsider because he was not Judean. So there's this Judean-Galilean insider-outsider rivalry thing going on. So the Passover, celebrated by the Judeans, was near, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And Matt, he went to Jerusalem because he was obligated to go, because he was a man, and all the men in all the Hebrew lands, the Hebrew-controlled lands, were required to make a pilgrimage to Jerusalem three times a year. And this is number one. Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread in the spring and the summertime. They did Pentecost, the Feast of... weeks is what that one's called in the summertime. And then in the fall, their harvest festival, Sukkot, booths, the festival of booths, the harvest festival in the fall. Men were required to make this pilgrimage. So Jesus goes up to Jerusalem. At the same time, this is important to note, there's an audience here, right? This is public theology, public art happening. Jesus goes up to Jerusalem, and in the temple, he found people selling cattle, sheep, doves, and the money changers seated at their tables. Folks were supposed to bring a sacrifice or an offering, which can sound a little crazy scary, right? Like, oh no, they had human sacrifices. Not that different from you bringing an offering to church, or you sending an offering via Venmo to @BBoulder. And here's the thing, though, right? People who came from really far away, like from Galilee, probably did not want to have to drive a cow on foot because they were walking, man. They didn't have horses. They didn't want to walk a cow all the way from the far end of Israel to Jerusalem. So instead, they would buy one there to give it as their offering. So that's why they're selling these cattle, sheep, and doves. Or, like, you're going to carry a dove in your pocket for 2 weeks to walk to Jerusalem?
Why not?
Oh, they didn't have bird cages, man. They had to tie a string to the dove's leg and just hold it like a June bug. Money changers were seated at the tables. Money changers were needed to do a couple of things. One of the things they needed to do was the denarius, which was the money of the day of the Roman Empire, had the face of Caesar on it. And that's a graven image because it also said, Caesar, son of God. So, Matt, we're going to go back to that first commandment, no other idols or gods before me. Problematic for Judeans and faithful Jews to be carrying false idols. So they changed it out and got literally kosher money that they could use as an offering there. So all that's going on. Jesus makes a whip out of cords. I don't know why they leave cords laying around the temple for people to go around and make a whip out of them.
It's a craft table right there.
They had open space, and you could craft the things, and Jesus took the stuff that he was going to make an Advent wreath out of, or a Passover wreath out of, and made a cord of whips, made a whip out of it. And he drove them all out of the temple, both the sheep and the cattle. The doves, I assume, stayed. So Jesus likes doves. But Jesus also poured out the coins of the money changers, overturned their tables, and he told those who were selling the doves, take these things out of here. Stop making my Father's house a marketplace. There's a key word for you, Matt. Stop making my Father's house a marketplace. Mark has the most similar account to this one. The ones in Luke and Matthew are pretty abbreviated. But Mark says, stop making my father's house a den of robbers, is what it says. Mm. And here we have a marketplace. His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." Zeal, also translated fairly often in the Bible as jealousy, Matt, which came up in the Exodus reading there. Jealousy for your house will consume me. And the Judeans said to him, "What sign can you show us for doing this?" I like that that's there. Okay, you're driven, you've built a homemade weapon, you've run us all out of this. We're totally okay with it if you can produce a sign that says you have the proper authority and credentials. Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Then the Judeans said, "This temple has been under construction for 46 years. It's still not finished. And will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking, of course, in retrospect, of the temple of his body. And after he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word Jesus had spoken. The gospel of the Lord, man.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Soft, fuzzy.
What a text. Soft, fuzzy Jesus. I appreciate all the, like, little commentary. That was like a HarperCollins Study Bible.
I got you.
You should do that. You should just do that when you're reading the gospel and worship. Just pause.
Right? I'd like to.
Places.
Throw in all the things I didn't fit into the sermon.
Right, exactly. Be great. Be great. This text came up in our some of our community organizing team conversations at St. Mark's. We were talking about, some folks like you, like, reminded me of this text and the importance of sometimes being
did they
angry.
Remind you of the text because they had just gathered some sticks from the ground and made a whip out of it and were about to chase you out of the church?
And they were not doing
well,
that.
That's good.
Not doing
that's
that. But we had gone to a public meeting, I'll presume, of course, and there were other people there to speak who were quite angry and who were lobbing some pretty pointed insults at our elected representatives. And we did not do that. We had a focused approach that we were doing. But folks said, Jesus got angry. And they pointed to this text as an example of when Jesus gets angry. They did not say zeal for God's house consumed Jesus. But people remember this as a story where Jesus expresses anger in, like, physical ways. Mm-hmm. This is it's an important text.
It is.
To look at. I wonder, in the Facebook group for the Lenten series that we're doing with A Sanctified Art, who should also be a sponsor, someone was wondering aloud how to preach this text, in the wake of, some folks, I think, who thought they were doing this at the Capitol building.
Yeah.
A few months ago, right? Clearly, we think those people are idiots. But still, where do you draw these kinds of distinctions, and how can you do that in a really clear way? And some of the conversation was about how, maybe in this time that we're living in, it's especially important to be just really, really clear about what Jesus is doing. And so I don't know, it's an interesting context in which to read.
So what is Jesus doing? These people, these money changers, right? They're clearly just providing a service.
Just providing a service. Also seems to be engaged in property destruction here. Seems to be pretty, I don't know. So anyway, there's that. Just gonna put that
how
on
would
table.
You differentiate
like
it, though, man? How would
like
you differentiate it?
For you.
You're not gonna solve it.
I'm not gonna solve it for you. I think if I'm thinking out loud, that there's something about. There are power dynamics at work in this text. And so, in terms of the way that I do theology, I think we have to think about where are the most vulnerable in this situation? Who is Jesus doing this on behalf of? And I'd kind of start there and think about that context. How would you differentiate it?
So I think there are a couple, like, it's, I think this is actually some difficult work that you need to do ahead of time if you're going to go down this road. Because a part of what money clearly is at the heart of this story. And there were some different cultural understandings of economics in the ancient Near East, but it gets used in lots of ways. I remember that, when I was, like, in youth group, we weren't allowed sometimes to, like, have a bake sale in the narthex because of this, right? Mm-hmm. That people could get really upset about that. The thing that is different here, and I've talked about it before on the podcast, right, is that in the ancient Near East, they had the idea that the economy was a limited goods economy, that there was, like, a set amount of money. A set amount of wealth existed in the world. And so anyone who worked to get more than their fair share was considered shameful or dishonorable. And so the merchant class, the business class, people who were wheeling and dealing were considered inherently shameful because they were making money, right? Making money off of money. That, I mean, that's the problem with making money off of money in the ancient Near East, right? Why tax collectors, why interest isn't allowed in the Bible, because you're taking money away from other people. You weren't, like, you couldn't create wealth in the way that we think that you can do that these days. The other, like, more clear route to take in explaining this is that the money changers really were taking advantage of rural people. Right. If you think about the fact that every male had an obligation to come to Jerusalem 3 times a year for these pilgrimages, and they had an obligation to have an offering on top of that when they got there, the people in the cities who didn't have to spend any money, who are already in Jerusalem, are there to sell them their sheep or goats after they've spent weeks walking, not farming, doing all these things. And then, essentially, Matt, the money changers are kind of like the merch table, the merch booth at Coachella. I know this is we're gonna hit close to home here, Matt. You're gonna hit.
That's what I'm doing next time we go. I'm gonna turn over the merch tables.
Right, exorbitant prices, because here's the thing, right? And, like, I would actually lean on this. This is an interesting angle to get into this that I learned about this week, thanks to Robin Molina, is that the pilgrimages were like Coachella. We talked about this a few weeks back when Jesus calls the disciples. Traveling was considered deviant behavior, like leaving your homestead, in kind of like American terms, for any reason outside of pilgrimage was not okay. Like, was very deviant behavior. 3 times a year, you get to go on this multi-week trip to the big city, and you get to leave behind the social structures and stuff. And so it is like this big party. It's Coachella, you know? And you get there and you get to, like, have this shared experience, and it bonds you all together as a common people. It played a really important role in the religious and political life of Judah and Israel. And so you get there, and it really, I think the parallel is pretty good, right? That, like, folks there who've spent a couple $100 on their Coachella ticket, who've had to buy pop-up tents at the last minute, were rushed in, right? And you're like, well, I gotta get that Beyonce homecoming jacket. Like, this is the only time I'll ever be able to buy the Beyonce homecoming jacket. It's $500? I guess I gotta do it, you know? And you put down the money. It's that same sort of, like, feeling.
It's a sacrifice.
And that's not a sacrifice that the urban elite of the ancient Near East had to make. So they are taking advantage of vulnerable, poor, rural folk.
Yeah, no, that's helpful. And I think, it is such an important text. This idea of this, I mean, just to have this example of Jesus doing this thing is so powerful. I feel like it's also important to note, like, that Jesus does a very specific thing. It's not like he goes in there and just, like, I don't know, goes berserk and doesn't have any kind of, like, he does some very specific things in there. And I'd classify it in present day terms as a nonviolent direct action, right? He doesn't go in there with a sword. He could have, like, that could have been another story. Yeah. You could imagine the story in a different way where he goes in there with a sword and he just butchers everyone. And he says, this is how it's going down, right? I mean, maybe in the Tarantino version, that's what happens.
Definitely.
That's not what he does. That's not what he, there is no record here of him hurting. He might hurt the pocketbooks of people, but there's no record of physical harm being done to anyone. It's a nonviolent direct action, a really specific, with a really specific target in a really specific kind of way. And to bring it full circle, I mean, I think that if the goal is building beloved community, if the goal is getting to this this kingdom, this new world that Jesus is proclaiming, that sometimes requires, to bring it full circle, deconstruction. And here's Jesus doing some deconstruction.
Yeah. Wow. Way to tie it all back together, man.
What a podcast. Tie it all back together. I'll tell you how. I'm going to tell you how I'm tying it together on Sunday, though.
How? How are you going
to
do it?
This relates to the vinyl preacher. So this was my sermon last Sunday. So so the theme that Sanctified Art put out was again and again, a Lenten refrain. The theme is again and again. It took me a while to get into it. What didn't get me at first, but then I just started thinking about again and again, going around again and again, and it just made me think of a vinyl record. Just made me think of a vinyl record, right? Going around,
round,
again
and again. Right, so you know what right, I did? Round.
Right, exactly. That's on the playlist that I made. And so last week, first week of Lent, 2 weeks ago in our podcast series, I talked about this idea that, you know, sometimes it feels like we're just spinning around. You look at that record on my record player, if I turn it on, it just spins until the needle comes down.
Yeah, wait for the drop.
And then suddenly there is sound. This needle drop. Without that needle drop, without that divine needle drop, it's just a record spinning around, just like clay without the breath of God. And so this is what happens at Jesus' baptism. The Spirit comes down like a needle.
Like the bass. Yeah.
It works. I was like, I literally said in the sermon, you thought my metaphor was out there. Look at the Spirit coming down like a needle. I mean, it's in the form of a dove. It's got a beak, a sharp pointy beak. It is literally, I didn't say beak, I didn't do that. But it comes down like a needle. That God comes down. If it's Luther
the
theology,
metaphor
too,
works
right, God
real
comes
good
down.
When you have to describe ornithology in detail.
Let me just tell you, though, people loved the metaphor. It worked.
It's great.
People really loved it. It was really fun. And so I was already looking ahead. I was like, I'm going to carry this through Lent, because here, what does Jesus do? It sounds like a bad dad joke. Is a turntable. It's a turntable. He turns the table. That was the bad dad joke that I was going to go with until one of the members typed in the chat last week, you know that full rotation is called a revolution.
What?
And then one of my music team members was like, yeah, and they talk about revolutions per minute. That's what the 33 and a third is, revolutions per minute. And I'm like, so maybe this Sunday we're talking about revolution, and we're talking about what kind of revolution Jesus is about. And wouldn't that be an interesting question to explore here? That would tie it back to a season of vinyl records. You heard it here on the Vinyl Preacher. You're welcome to use that.
That's what we should do. Merch. We should merch up. Well, I guess we can't sell other people's music. Never mind. The idea was putting the playlist on vinyl, like, so you can buy the Lent album, you know? But the Vinyl Preacher legal team is not great. We're represented by Nathan Fielder, Esquire. So what are you listening to, Matt? What is on your turn
table? That's where I went. So so I was listening to the new Springsteen Obama podcast, which is which is really called Renegades Born in the USA, which is an incredible title. A Friendship Made in America, because two famous people can be friends. But one of the protest songs that that they suggested, I can't remember who said, I think it was Obama, Maggie's Farm by Bob Dylan, which then made me remember that song, and it is so good. There are lots of covers of it, but I still think Dylan Dylan does it best. And he's it's like Angry Dylan. It's so good. It's just great. So Maggie's Farm.
Is that Jacob or is that
and
Bob?
Maggie. What?
Is that Jacob or Bob?
Jacob. Not Jacob. That'd be One Headlight, which is not what we're going to use here. But I can see Maggie's Farm. If you were making a movie of this, Maggie's Farm could be the soundtrack.
I ain't working on Maggie's Farm no more.
For Jesus. I mean, would it be an interesting soundtrack?
If you're talking about the exodus, like people on the farms getting taken advantage of, the rural people, making their journey to Jerusalem.
All that stuff. And then, I mean, thinking about the thousandth generation, this thing that extends through the generations, T-Rex, children of the revolution, you won't fool the children of the revolution. And I'll say it is the youngest members sometimes of our organizing team that continue to push me and hold me accountable to this example of Jesus here. So the children of the revolution, you're not going to fool them. And then finally, person that got me thinking about this whole turntable thing in the first place. Janelle Monáe's single Turntables from last fall, where it begins with the table about to turn, and she takes that into a higher and higher register. It builds in such a powerful way. Table about to turn. Janelle Monáe, Turntables.
I like it. I like it. Matt, one of a good friend of the pod, Rick Fry, posted a salacious thing on Facebook. I don't know if you saw this, Matt. He wanted to know what was the best REM album of all time, and why it was Green, I think is what he went with. And I, of course, responded by calling him a sellout by suggesting that a Warner Brothers REM album was the greatest one of all time, when clearly, it's a document.
Clearly.
Obvious document was the artistic peak, and then they sold out, you know? Everybody knows it. They cashed their checks like they needed to cash checks. And
not automatic for the people? You're not going automatic for the people on this? No?
I mean, so they're great albums. There are many great albums to choose from. I am intrigued that Rick went with Green, because that's not traditionally, you know, considered one of the, like, the great albums, you know?
Sure.
That... I mean, Out of Time was the most commercially successful, and remarkably commercially successful for something as artistically, like, successful as it was. Like, if you go back and listen to it, it's just hard to imagine that sold. Like,
right, it's really weird. It's eclectic.
Sold, like, it has mandolin, you know, there's mandolin.
Yeah.
There's rap. Right. There's, like, that white, like, weird, like, people were, like... white rap, like, in the early 90s thing, over, like, rap is happening. Yeah, let's try that.
Right. Yep.
Shiny Happy People is on there. Super weird and sold like crazy. Honorary for the People is great. It's fantastic. But I think Document. I mean, finest work song. Xumi McCarthy. Disturbance at the Heron House. It's the End of the World as We Know It. The One I Love, which, you know... Oddfellas Local 151, and a track, the second track off that, Matt, which is a killer that people forget about. Really good. Welcome to the Occupation off of Document, going on the playlist this week, as Jesus says welcome, as we welcome Jesus, or Jesus welcomes us. Somebody's getting welcomed to the Occupation. It's killer. It's killer. Matt, then wow. I'm going to go with a track off of The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, one of the greatest albums of all time. Because I feel like Jesus is kind of singing the chorus here. The chorus is playing as Jesus is running the money changers out of the temple. You might win some, but you just lost one. As he's turning the tables over. Lost ones, Lauryn Hill. The Miseducation of said Lauryn Hill. And finally, Matt, I didn't get to get into it as much as I wanted to, but like Wilbur and Molina do have like a really nice piece in their commentary on John on what, like, how awesome pilgrimage was for people who were not allowed to travel ever. And it made me think of Coachella so much. And this week, I've been playing... This is a little... I've started playing Pokemon Go with my daughter. Neither of us really understand what's going on. We've got a bunch of them. and I was running into like the post office and left her in the car, and she was messing with Pokemon Go. And when I came back in, she was playing Portugal the Man. And I hadn't listened to Portugal the Man in a while, and so I thought back immediately to seeing them at Coachella and feel it still when they were putting the captions on the screen behind them, especially the caption that said, "Your mom loves this song."
It was so good. We didn't expect it either. Like, it was very, like... It's great.
Don't worry. We want us to Beyonce, too. We'll be done soon. It was so good. So, Portugal, period, space, the man.
Amen. Good stuff.
It's a good week here on the pod. Mm-hmm. Good playlist. I've grouped Matt on Spotify all of the Lent, so we just have one Lent playlist, a seasonal playlist, so you can click on the link in the description, and it'll take you right over to all the songs, not just this week's.
Good job. Good job.
I have two songs. No, I don't. Never mind. I'm a liar.
Well, it's been real 180 gram.
Vinyl. I mean, like, vinyl applies this time.